He's not dead. Are you really in control, Admiral Sloan?
She points his own blaster toward him.
I'm in control of this conversation. Of that, you must be assured.
Yes, of course.
He swallows hard.
This is an opportunity.
For a long time, he felt himself sliding down the side of a mountain, a slow and unending slip down the scree.
But here is a handhold.
He doesn't understand it. He cannot say where it will take him should he avail himself of it.
This isn't hope, not yet, but it's close.
I don't know where Rax came from, but I know how you could find out.
Tell me.
Those droids I spoke of. They might know the boy that Rax once was. Their memory banks might have data. If not the droids, then the data banks of the ship itself. The Imperialis.
A slicer could access the data in those droids, she says. If I knew where they were.
I know where they are.
A cold silence stretches out between them. Finally, she says,
tell me where.
And what will I get?
You will get not shot.
Hardly good enough, he says. My lust for life is a dead and withered thing, Admiral Sloan. I am a broken fixture on the wall of an empty palace. If you want my help, I want a place in your empire. If it is your empire, well, is it?
She narrows her eyes, suspicious of him, as she should be.
It is, or will be. I can give you a place. You know how to run an empire, after all.
Yes,
he thinks.
I know how to run one, even if I don't know how to leave one. Rax is still alive, isn't he? You don't have to answer. I see the fear in your eyes. You're a prisoner of your own command. Just like me. Perhaps we can plot our escape together. Perhaps we can take over the prison.
He idly drags a nail against his teeth. Click, click, click.
The droids are in storage, along with the wreckage of the Imperialis itself.
Where?
Where else? Quan Chi, the junk moon of Ord Mantell.
Part 2. Interlude. The Alderaan Flotilla.
Asteroids tumble through space. They drift and spiral. And when one hits the perimeter shield, it breaks. Bits drift, pulverized, as the rest of the rock pirouettes away to join the rest of its crumbling brethren. Every time it happens, it hurts Tevin Gale's heart. Because that asteroid is a piece of his world. Was a piece of his world, anyway. Out there waits an infinite black space horizon of Alderaan, now reduced to rock. The flotilla is safe, at least. 7 ships belong to the flotilla now, including the Alderaanian frigate Sunspire. Another gift from the nascent Republic. Or rather, another gift from their princess. The ships float near to one another, gathering in a circle and protected by the deflector shield to keep out both the asteroids and, hopefully, marauders.
The galaxy is drifting toward lawlessness, he thinks.
Better that, though, than choked in the black steel gauntlet of Darth Vader. Out in the black, demo droids drill and dig into the asteroids, one by one. They look like fireflies out there, with their bright orange light flickering from their cutting lasers. Those droids look for anything of note from the world the Alderaanians lost. Artifacts, remains, fragments of precious stones or minerals or metals. Even a single brick would be a find. Accessing any of this wasn't even an option under Imperial rule. The Empire blockaded all access to the Alderaanian graveyard. Behind him, the argument. The one he tries to tune out continues. Eaglin Valmore is up and pacing, as is her wont.
This is our home. This patch of sky is ours. Our world was here. And the diaspora has returned us to this place. We are home, and I will not leave it.
She tugs on the loose braid from her ice-blonde hair. She's young, Gale thinks, unlike himself. But she's got a vital heart. He likes her. She and the others are not royals. There exists only one of those now. But they are what the world has left. Alderaan has to be ruled by someone, and the commoners are what remains. Valmore is not queen, but rather regent administrator.
Bah!
Says Ikar Orlis, once a teacher at a university. The man sits back in his chair, idly scratching at the peaky beard rising up off his jowls like mountains of chef's meringue.
This is no world, regent administrator. Forgive me for saying, it's just rock. Blasted, wretched rock. The Empire turned our world into salt and dust. And though I'm old, I for one don't want to be like some geriatric clutching to his chest the remnants of what once was. It's time to demand resettlement. I've prepared a list of worlds we could colonize.
That's not how it works, chimes in Argus Tanzer. Argus is a young bureaucrat, possessing a handsomeness that looks less cultivated and more like someone simply carved him out of quartzine. Argus thrusts up a finger, gesturing with it as he speaks. The New Republic won't be keen on us just picking some planet and resettling there. There's a process. He lowers his voice when he adds, not that anyone quite knows what the process is. Orlis barks.
All the more reason to seize the chance now. We can claim that the Republic simply did not have their bows tied and they're not cinched. We seize upon their ignorance.
Besides,
adds Janus Pole, an elder diplomat, a small woman as sharp and as pale as a broken tooth. She steeples her fingers and stares over them.
We are not yet members of the Republic. We are,
says Ryena Tor. She's young, too young to be here, Gale thinks. But when the Empire destroyed their world, what was left but those who were living off-world? Ryena was with her missionary parents, part of a roving school dedicated to helping those in the galaxy who could not so easily help themselves. Now she's back and fulfilling a similar mission, isn't she?
We can't help ourselves, Tevin thinks. He reminds himself, we're all just asteroids tumbling into one another.
Ryena continues, visibly nervous as she says,
we are a member of the New Republic. Leia is one of the most vital members.
And yet we have no senator,
Orlis says.
We've no representation. We've no vote. What has Leia given us? Is she even truly our princess? None of us are royals. Why do we think she would listen to us?
It's time to speak up. Gale turns and offers words in a stern tone when he says, Leia has already listened to us. She's given us this flotilla. Four of these ships are from her. The supplies we use to survive are from her.
We exist, gathered together, because of the efforts of her and Yvonne Verlaine, and the other Alderaanians working on Chandrilla. I'll not have her name sullied in this room.
That earns murmurs and mumbles of both agreement and dissent. He hopes the dissenters will change their tune soon enough. As if on cue, in the center of the Korobite table, a table carved from one of the asteroids and formed of Alderaanian bedrock and schist, lights up with an incoming message. Above the table floats Rickert Beagle, one of the comm officers on the Sunspire.
We have incoming ships, he says, visibly worried.
Who is it?
The regent administrator asks, leaning in.
We don't know,
but the ships are big.
They damn well should be,
Tevin thinks. Hauling cargo that big, well, you just can't pull it along with a couple of tug-tugs. The worry rises in the room. Whispers of pirates or bandits. Fear of a resurgent empire. Or perhaps worse, some brutal fragment of what remains of the empire. Certainly rumors have persisted of various worrisome remnants of the Imperial forces that have gone mad out there in space. Rickert suddenly says,
Wait! We have a signature. Code clearance says it's New Republic.
Beyond the asteroid field, ships begin to pop out of hyperspace. Big ships. Cargo freighters whose cargo will not fit within those ships' bellies. Cargo so big, it must in fact be contained in its own shield, lashed to the ships with magna beams. The scrap they haul is epic in size. Huge curved slices like the rind of some fruit designed only for the massive hand of an old god. Those with Tevin gather at the glass, staring out.
What am I looking at?
Valmore asks.
It is a gift from our princess. I had to pull quite a few strings just to get this on the table. But as it turns out, nobody was really doing anything with it. It was just going to end up as scrap elsewhere. I started the ball rolling, but it was Leia who really made it happen. Her and Yvonne. Orlis growls.
I still don't know what that is or why we'd want it.
But Tanzer sees it. He smirks.
It's pieces of that damnable Death Star, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Tevin laughs and nods.
They reduced us to scrap. Now we get their scrap as reparations for war. This is just the first lot of it, too. Quite a bit more coming if we say the word.
We could build a whole space station of our own,
the Regent Administrator says, beaming. She presses her hands against the glass, and therein lies the wonderment of a child, even though she is one no longer.
That's my hope, Tevin says. What say the rest of you?
Orlis grumbles some kind of reluctant acquiescence, then stomps off. Pole, another dissenter, shrugs.
We can try this, but resettlement will still be on the table. And we must be afforded a voice in the Senate if we are to aid the New Republic in any of its efforts to secure the galaxy.
Their conversation fades as Tevin looks at the Regent Administrator. An untested, untrained, politically naive young woman whose eyes are as big as moons and whose heart is as bright as 10 suns. The awe in her eyes is so tangible, Tevin thinks he could bask in it, drink it up even.
This is our future,
she says, not to him, not to any of them, but to the glass and to the space beyond.
Yes, he thinks. I hope it is.
Chapter 11.
The moth drops out of hyperspace into the open black of nowhere. For a moment, Nora finds the open emptiness overwhelming, as if it's going to swallow her whole. Once upon a time, she found the expanse of space comforting. So much potential, so much freedom. These days, it only offers her terror, from which she must wrest her own respite. She tries Leia's trick, closing her eyes, drawing a deep breath, exhaling slowly. Nora tries to reclaim that feeling of freedom, and finding even that difficult, she just lets herself sit there. In, out. Clear the mind. Become one with the stars. And then, it helps. She feels less lost, less overwhelmed, more centered.
Thanks, Leia.
She cuts the engines, and the ship floats there. The moth once belonged to the smuggler, Huerto Neucho. but he lost his life during the rebellion on Akiva after helping Nora get planetside. That left the MK-4 freighter up for grabs. Nora considered selling it, but truth is, how long can she live this life? She was a pilot for the Rebel Alliance, and now leads a team of Imperial hunters for the New Republic. This work has to have an expiration date, she tells herself. And yet, she keeps coming back for job after job. Either way, it seemed like a good idea to have a ship of her own for once. Something that belonged to the Wexley name. If she dies, or when, since immortality is not likely, then Temin will have something to call his own. He is becoming a good pilot. He deserves it. Especially since his father is gone. He should have something of his own. Right now, though, Temin isn't here. Though she's not alone either. See anything? Wedge asks, hobbling into the cockpit. Nora points at the viewscreen.
Out there in the foreground of the glittering stars float bits of gleaming metal.
Wreckage. Giving her a little thrust, Nora says. And she does. The moth eases forward.
Wedge leans over her, accidentally bumping into her.
They share an awkward laugh as he clears his throat and, sets up the scanner. After a few key taps, a green beam, glittering like precious stones, flung onto a cloth of black velvet, sweeps the void in front of them. First a vertical scan, then horizontal, pulsing as it searches and catalogs. This space represents the coordinates of the Millennium Falcon, when Solo and Chewie were trapped by the Empire. The Falcon wasn't destroyed here, was it? There's a lot of debris, Nora asks.
I doubt it, Wedge says. Leia didn't say as much. Besides, the Falcon has gotten out of more scrapes than the galaxy has stars, I think.
Nora can personally attest to that. She remembers watching the blue burn of the freighter's engines as it whipped through the narrow channels and conduits inside the belly of the second Death Star. The ship clipped a pipe and lost its retina array, the dish spinning off as Nora's Y-wing went past. Wedge goes on to say,
"Something sure happened out here. Look at this."
Data scrolls on the nav screens.
Wreckage from at least 4 different ships. None of them the Falcon. Let's see what we have. 3 freighters, 1 fighter. Wait, Imperial wreckage too. Scrap from a TIE Wings panel. What a mess. I don't know that we're going to find any clues to Chewie's whereabouts out here, Nora.
Let's pull in the scrap. See if we can't eyeball something.
I'll get the tractor beam cooking, he says.
Wedge eases into the co-pilot's chair. As he spins up the beam controls, he looks over at Nora.
Thanks for having me along. It's nice being out in the black again. Planetside's all right, but out here, this is home.
It won't be long before you're back in action.
I hope so.
He hesitates. He looks like he wants to say something.
What is it?
After this, after we find Han, because I know we will, do you want to,
He coughs into his hand and wets his lips.
You want to go out and get a drink sometime? I know this little cliffside cantina.
Movement on the viewscreen.
They both see it.
Nora says,
Did you see that?
Something darts from one piece of scrap to another. It moves like a squid through water, tentacles pushing off, legs like a blooming flower whose petals are closing. There's a red glow before the shadowy shape is again behind another piece of scrap, hiding there, where the sensor beam wouldn't have found it.
Wedge says, Let's see what we've got.
The tractor beam hums as it fires up.
I'm not your babysitter, Singier says.
Good, because I'm not a baby.
Temin and Sinjir head down the hall toward a door guarded by two New Republic soldiers with vibro-staves crossing the door.
I never said you were a baby. Good, because I'm not.
Before they get to the door, Sinjir stops and plants a hand on Temin's chest.
Listen, the pouty angry teenage thing, it's tiring. I know. Does that mean you're going to stop doing it?
Temin asks, crossing his arms and cocking his eyebrows. The smirk that crosses Sinjir's face will not be denied.
You think you're clever, do you? He sighs.
At least the boy told that mad droid of his to stay home when asked.
Believe me, I speak from experience when I say that cleverness will earn you as many enemies as it does friends. So, take it down a notch. We've got work to do. It's just...
But then the boy shuts up. Sinjir knows he's going to regret this, in much the same way one might regret sticking a hand into a hive of red jacket wasps in the hope that they make honey. Hint, they don't. But he asks anyway.
Oh, fine. What is it?
I don't know what I'm doing here.
We're here to visit one of our estimable prisoners.
No, I mean like, here. Like,
The boy makes a wild, frenetic gesticulation. That sound, that movement, perfectly articulates a specific feeling. That's when Sinjir understands the problem.
Ah, the existential here. I don't know what that means. It means you're having a crisis of identity.
Temin fidgets.
Yeah, I guess.
Congrats, my boy. It means you become a proper adult.
So you don't have it figured out?
Hardly. I'm utterly bewildered 9 times out of 10. I just happen to make it look good. I don't know what I'm doing here either. I suspect that the moment I have it figured out, I'll probably die 1/2 a second later. Because if there's one mystical energy that powers the galaxy, it's not the Force. It's pure, unadulterated irony. Now, let's go talk to General Shale. See if she can't help us in our foolhardy quest to locate the errant smuggler.
I hate this place,
Jom says, following Jazz through a narrow, crooked alley on Nar Shaddaa. Behind them is the mouth of one of the moon's countless black markets. This one is lorded over by the maven Nyarla the Hutt, a slime-dripping slug woman whose red tongue slathered the nozzle of a bubbling spice drip while she told them she didn't know a damn thing about Solo, his Wookiee, or Imperial prisons out in wild space.
You want to hang with me? Jazz says. You should get used to places like this, Barel.
At that, Jom feels mighty conflicted. He does want to hang with Jazz. His attraction to her is something on a whole other level. It's practically feral. His greatest desire right now is to grab her and pull her into some dark alcove and have another go. And yet, why? She's nothing like him. He's a man of order and principle. She's a fragging bounty hunter of all things. A criminal haven like this is second nature to her. Meanwhile, he feels like a Mon Cala out of water. Like he's drowning in open air, totally exposed.
This is a strange place for a date, he says.
You're funny. It's not a date. Don't think that what we had will happen again. It was just a bit of fun, is all.
They pass a stall full of wide-mouthed, toothy aliens, barking about a table full of strange oils and unguents. He slaps their hands away as they reach for him, and he calls after Jazz.
No reason the fun has to end.
Fun always has to end, Barel.
They push on toward the spaceport. Really, it's just a ship receptacle carved out of the urban sprawl. Jazz paid some crumple-headed weequay too many credits to keep their ship hidden and off syndicate registers. She told Jom that Black Sun operates out here. and the last thing she wants is to be on their screens. Them or the Crimora.
I have debts,
she told him. He asked her what kind, but she didn't elucidate. As they duck under a ratty tapestry hanging from a fraying rope and enter the spaceport, Jom says,
This is the third time we've come up empty, Amari. Maybe it's time to realize that your underworld connections here are drying up. Time to go back to Chandrilla, and...
The air warbles, and something hits Jom in the back, knocking the air out of him. He pitches forward, chin hitting the ground and teeth biting into his tongue. Blood fills his mouth as he tries to summon his limbs to move, but they don't respond to his commands.
I've been stunned.
He barely manages the will to lift his chin off the dirty ground, and he sees Jazz pinned down by a series of red lights. Beam sights, he realizes. Dozens of them, all from weapons threatening to fire. Her hands are up in surrender as enemies close in from the shadows.
Frag!
The airlock shudders as the moth's oxygen cyclers pump air into it. Wedge steps forward, leaning hard on his cane. He and Nora share a look. Then she jams the big red button with the heel of her hand. The door slides open with a rattling bang. There, inside, sit heaps of scrap drawn into the ship with the tractor beam. Already she sees plasma scoring and char marks. What she doesn't see is anything moving.
I know I saw something out there, she says.
Wedge nods.
We both saw it.
Just then, a piece of hull scrap shifts, groaning against the floor. Then all is silent once more. The two of them draw their blasters. A faint scuttling and scraping. And again, nothing. Moments pass. Wedge starts to say,
Maybe together we could lift...
The scrap piece flips up suddenly, slamming against the wall with a deafening bang! A dark shape, big as an astromech, takes flight, slamming into Wedge. He screams as he falls.
The tea here, right?
Sidgir says, holding up his steaming cup as if to demonstrate. He takes a noisy sip, while Temin stares disappointedly down at his own cup.
It's a far sight better than what we got at Imperial Commissary, that's for certain.
Jilia Shale was once a general in the Empire's army, and legendarily one hell of a strategist. Sadly, her legend was habitually ignored by those above her. She sits with both of her small hands around a cup of her own.
It is something, but I had my own supply during the Empire days.
The apartment is spare, but functional. It's more than she'd get in a prison cell. She has a food prep station instead of a protein recycler, a proper bathroom instead of a vacuum-suck porthole, and no interrogator droids hovering about. All because she has played along and given the New Republic true answers to the questions it has posed.
House arrest is quite nice, Sinjir thinks. I should have gotten arrested.
He could live a comfortable life in one of these boxes, as long as they delivered liquor.
Did they?
He makes a mental note to ask. Then he sets the tea down because tea is disgusting.
So, nothing?
He asks, rapping his knuckles gently on the low table between them. He gestures toward the star map hovering there holographically.
You don't know anything about this base? We're looking for Imperials. Any at all you think might be in that area?
If no answers present themselves, that means Solo is... what? Investigating that region of his own daft giggles? Perhaps he's truly gone back to the smuggler life, succumbed to the pressure of adult life, and bailed on the wife and the coming child. Perhaps Solo kissed the straight and narrow goodbye, and he's gone off to have his own illicit adventures. It's what Sinjir would do. It's what Sinjir did, at least. Still, Shale is lying. He can tell she's withholding. It's strange sitting here, interrogating someone of Shale's stature. Though he supposes her stature has fallen considerably. Not in his mind, though. Interrogating her, and that's what this is, just a more polite version of it, makes him feel rather uncomfortable. He tries not to show it, though.
"Do you miss it?"
Shale suddenly asks.
"What's that?" "The warm embrace of the Empire."
"Ah, an embrace as warm as a hug from a slab corpse." He taps his thumbnail against the side of the teacup. Tink, tink, tink. "No, I don't miss it. I don't miss who I was or what I did in its service. I miss who I was once before the Empire turned me into me. Not that I much remember that version of myself, but I'm quite confident he existed. He may have even been nice."
"I don't miss it either. What we did formed a scar across this galaxy, and I'm not sure it will ever truly fade."
She sighs.
"You should go ask Tashu. I don't know anything, but he and his other sycophant advisors seemed awfully enamored of that region. Good luck finding whatever it is you seek, Loyalty Officer Rathvelis."
And with that, they are dismissed.
Wedge squirms and kicks under the clicking limbs of an Imperial probe droid. Not a Viper, but one of the smaller Prowler models. The droid's flat, disc-shaped body suddenly glows red around the margins and emits a high-pitched trill. Nora recoils from the sound, her ears ringing. It's a noise so terrible it feels like it's trying to bore into her skull. All she can do is steady her hand, take aim, and... her blaster shot slams the probe droid back, sending its top popping off. Its spider legs, free from the body, come away in Wedge's hands, and he flings them to the ground before kicking them away with his one good leg. His hair is a mess. His cheek is bleeding. Nora rushes over, grabs a kerchief from her pocket, and dabs at it. "Hold still," she tells him. Thankfully, it's not serious. Just a scrape from one of the thing's limbs. The droid sits in the corner, sparking and smoking. The red light shines bright one last time, then goes dark. At least the sound is gone. What was that sound? Self-defense mechanism? The two of them are left sitting and staring at it.
"Why is there a probe droid out here?"
he asks, panting. She helps him stand.
"Searching the wreckage like we were?"
Could be.
"But why remain out here? That's a Prowler probe. They don't travel long distances. They're local."
"They forgot it?" she posits. "It's easy enough to leave behind, especially if things got violent."
"That doesn't sound like the Empire."
"Maybe not the old one, but in its current state, they're different now, less efficient." Her brow wrinkles.
"Hey, those probes don't travel far, but how's their transmission range? Could it have been..."
Wedge grabs his cane and uses it to move toward the droid. With the toe of his boot, he lifts it. Sure enough, on the underside is a modular comm array. A little transceiver dish that would have been hidden by its limbs. That dish is blinking green.
"It's still transmitting," Nora says. "What could they possibly be?"
From the cockpit, a proximity alarm. Its presence could mean only one thing. Incoming ships! Nora rushes out of the hold and into the cockpit, spinning the chair and plonking herself down just in time to see a Star Destroyer cut through space like a spear tip.
Drool drips from Jom's chin as he grunts, pushing himself up on shaky arms. Ugh. He falls back down, pain radiating through his old shoulder injury. With one hand, he fumbles gamely for the blaster rifle, hanging on his back. But the toe of a boot pries his hand away and gently steps on it.
It's Jazz's boot. Her hands are still up. She looks down at him and shakes her head, clucking her tongue.
No, no. Stay still.
Jazz,
he moans.
Shh.
And with that, they are surrounded. Ridge-browed Nyctos emerge, hand cannons held aloft, beam sights all targeting Jazz. Their nose slits flare, as if sniffing for her scent. Blunt-toothed mouths gnash and clamp open air. They ease apart as a new player enters the scene. A woman, by the look of her. Face hidden behind a rust-pocked metal mask. The mask is curved, and the top of the metal is curled into the facsimile of curved horns. A pair of trillium lenses whir and buzz as they focus in on Jazz. The woman tilts her head and says,
Hello, Imari.
Underboss Vinskar,
Jazz says.
Been a while.
That's because you've been avoiding me. Playing Susie Good Girl with the New Republic, I hear.
Job's a job, and last I checked, I needed credits.
The masked woman stiffens.
You do. To pay me. You have debts.
My aunt had debts.
And now they're yours!
Rinskar barks, suddenly furious.
But since you don't seem to be able to pay, I have little choice here but to bring your head back to Boss Gyuti. Black Sun demands money or blood, bounty hunter. Will it be blood? There is a bounty on your head.
Jom thinks.
I won't let this happen.
He again starts to lift himself up, but Jazz slams her foot down on his back. She hisses at him.
Stop! They'll kill you and kill me. And then what? I'll handle it.
Then to Rinskar.
Who sold me out? It was the hut, wasn't it?
The huts are in disarray. Nyala has come back to Black Sun.
I will pay you what I owe.
We've all heard that one before.
I'll make you a deal.
Rinskar sniffs behind the mask. The Nyctos gathered all share looks and laugh.
What deal could you make me?
I'll pay you twice what I owe. And failing that, I'll turn myself in. And the group I work with.
She'd really betray us?
He again starts to get up, protesting, and she grinds her heel against the back of his neck.
Interesting.
Rinskar hisses. Her head tilts at a curious angle.
And all I have to do is let you scamper away out of my grip?
Actually,
Jazz says, offering a nervous laugh.
There's one more thing. I need information.
Don't we all?
The underboss hesitates.
What is it?
I need to locate someone. The smuggler. Han Solo.
Imperial advisor Yup Tashu was, is, and forever will be a wild-eyed religious zealot. His capture on Akiva did little to dampen his fervor, and in fact, seems to have allowed it to further infect his mind. That presents Sinjir with two problems. First, Tashu's devotion to the Empire, or more particularly, to Palpatine himself, is so intense it utterly overwhelms his fragile sense of self-interest. Second, he's as mad as a spark-drunk Minok. It's very hard to interrogate one who suffers from one of these problems, much less both of them. The deranged only offer cryptic or nonsense answers, while the self-sacrificial will gladly immolate themselves in the service of keeping their trap shut. Sinjir hasn't gotten anywhere with Tashu since they brought him in, and by the look of his cell, things have only gotten worse. The man stands there behind the buzzing laser shield. he paces the cage like a pilgrim who has lost his way, wandering the world with a vague sense of purpose and faith, but no actual destination. The walls have been marked up in his food waste. Strange symbols and maps and other indecipherable gibberish are drawn there. Temin stares. Sinjir sees that this is upsetting the boy. That's interesting. Something about Tashu has gotten to him. It's cracked the boy's veneer of false confidence.
I don't think I can do this, Temin says.
You don't have to,
Sinjir says. Run along.
But, Temin,
it's okay. Go. The boy cannot seem to tear his gaze away, so Sinjir helps him by turning the boy in the other direction and urging him forth with a gentle push. It's enough. Temin leaves. The only other one that's left now is the guard, a Chandrillan man with a swoop of blonde hair and a light scar along his chin.
Is Tashu usually like this?
Sinjir asks. The guard regards Sinjir with cold gray eyes, then reluctantly offers a curt nod. There's discomfort there with the guard, and Sinjir's left to wonder why. Maybe the guard doesn't trust him. That's fine. He shouldn't.
Open the cage.
You have your orders, do you not?
But still, the guard hesitates. And there, Sinjir realizes, is the glorious yet naive failing of the New Republic. It isn't a fully fledged government. It isn't a proper military. In the Empire, you didn't turn down an order. You didn't hesitate. Hesitation meant reprimand. Failure meant Vader making 3 long strides into your office and pinching your windpipe shut with the power of his mind. In the Empire, the chain of command was everything. Someone above you told you to drop your pants and spin around 3 times? You did it. You didn't ask questions. Here, though, individuality rules the roost. That was, at least on paper, a benefit, right? You get to think your own thoughts, do your own good. If something doesn't sound right or smell right, you speak up. But when that happens, order breaks down. The saying might be too many admirals, not enough ensigns, but here that's not precisely true. Because in the New Republic, there aren't enough admirals either. And given that Mon Mothma has already begun trying to figure out how to demilitarize the galaxy, how long before it falls apart? Before it spins off its axis and bounces away? It wouldn't take much. The Empire couldn't even keep it together. And in that gap, the disease known as the Rebel Alliance formed. A disease that is presently killing its host. How long before the New Republic suffers the same gap? How long before the Empire returns the attack with its own infection? The Empire pushed too hard. But maybe the New Republic isn't pushing hard enough. Ugh, he needs a drink. Sinjir lends a John Burrell growl to his voice and says,
"You open that cage, guardsman, or I open your head!"
Fine, the guard says, staring balefully. He opens the cell.
Thank you,
Sinjir says, then steps inside. He tells the guard to turn the shield back on, which the man does, if reluctantly. Gently, Sinjir folds his hands behind his back. Best to give the veneer of authority here. Stand like an officer, and maybe, just maybe, Tashu will fall into an old pattern. He'll conjure the sense memory of what it was to serve in Palpatine's empire, and he'll nod and smile, bow and scrape, and give answers to the questions that Sinjir will ask.
Hello, Visor Tashu.
I remember you.
Yes, I imagine you do. Now, I'd like to ask you a little something about Imperial prisons.
I know nothing of those.
We shall see, Advisor.
And so Sinjir weighs in, trying to pluck at the man's strings. hoping dearly to get him to confide, one ex-imperial to another, just where the Empire might have taken a theoretically high-value target like Chewbacca. Or if there's something, anything out there Solo might be looking for. And all the while, the man in front of him continues to break down mentally, until he's crumpled into himself, the barest human shape gutted of its stuffing. His shoulders rock as he laughs quietly to himself before that laughter dissolves into weeping. His hands to pluck at each other. They pick at the nails until they've gone bloody. Sinjir just stands idly by, watching. He didn't have to do any of this. He didn't lay one finger on the man's messy, sweat-slick head. Tashu wound himself up to a complete and total freak fit, babbling about how he keeps trying to open himself up to something, because we're all bound in its web. But he cannot hear its voice, cannot feel its tremors, and how all he can do now is trust in his gut and trust in the instructions he was given. And that's it, Sinjir thinks. The game is over. He won't get anything of value from this gabbling freak. Sinjir's communicator pings. Pardon me, he says to Tashu, then steps out of the cell. The guard, with the shock of blonde hair, watches as Sinjir talks into the comlink. It's Jazz on the other side.
I have information.
Good. Because I'm not getting anything from this human methane fire. I would get better results if I asked a rain puddle.
What I have isn't complete. Ask Tashu about Iridiro.
Is that some kind of delicacy?
It's a system near wild space.
Iridiro, you say? All right. Back in he goes, then.
The weapons at the fore of a Star Destroyer are many. The main battery alone presents a host of turbolasers that could tear an entire space station to ribbons. But therein lies the value of being in a smaller ship. Just as it's hard to spot a fly, it's hard for a Star Destroyer to eliminate a single small craft. Provided, of course, that the littler ship acts like a fly. Sitting still, or even just retreating in a straight line, won't cut it. But puts a hard spin on the moth, corkscrewing it through open space, even as the massive capital ship wastes no time unloading a fusillade of weapons fire at them. The dark vacuum of space lights up with ship-killing spears of laser fire tearing past them. Wedge braces himself against the dash as he straps in and operates the weapons system. Time for a little roll off the top. It's a maneuver she learned early in her days doing combat cargo runs for the Alliance, though some of the pilots call it an Imalgan turn, after the one who reportedly originated it, Cargan Imalgan, one of the earliest Alliance aces, a hero, now dead, like so many of them. Nora accelerates forward, then pulls up hard. The moth lifts through the open black, lasers chasing the space where the ship was only half a moment before. She brings the ship from level to a half loop, then a hard roll and turn, so that the craft is now going the other direction entirely. Which is to say, it's heading straight for the Star Destroyer. It's like facing down a monstrous beast poised to swallow you, and choosing to run toward its open maw rather than away from it. This is crazy, Wedge says with a smile of admiration. Let's hope it's the best kind of crazy, she says, before giving the ship maximum thrust. Just as the Star Destroyer ejects a swarm of TIE fighters into space. Back on the halo, John shakes his head, struggling to claw free from the mud that remains after being stunned by those thugs. Through blurry vision, he sees Jazz finish up her communication with Sinjir. Then she turns toward him. She's clearly worked up. Her blood must be running hot. Her hands flex in and out of fists. He can't tell if she's angry, excited,
or both.
You sold us all out back there, he growls.
Relax, Barrel. I'm not giving up the team. I just needed to buy us more time.
Buy yourself more time, you mean?
But she doesn't respond to that. Instead, she says,
You think what she gave us is right? Will that lead us to Solo?
Slag if I know. Point is, I don't know if I can trust...
She slams into him, knocking him back. He's about to protest when she mashes her lips into his. Her tongue snakes into his mouth.
Hey!
He snarls.
What is this?
No reason the fun has to end just yet,
she says. Sound logic, he thinks, just before she renews her assault on his face. Sinjir merely has to say the name. Iradiru! With that one word uttered, Tashu freezes. He stops weeping and laughing. He stops biting at his fingertips.
Iradiru,
he repeats.
You know it.
I do.
Is there a prison on Iradiru?
No.
What is there, then?
Not a prison,
Tashu says.
But a prison maker.
The Ties form a screaming swarm behind them, spitting lasers. The moth jolts and bumps as the aft of the ship is struck and stung. Wedge starts to spin up the nav computer, plotting a course through hyperspace, even as Nora dives closer to the Star Destroyer, meaning any shots the Ties take at her pepper the surface of their own capital ship. She banks hard past the turret, escaping its twin fire, then whips the ship back around, ensuring that the turret will be too slow to track her.
Almost there, Wedge says.
Gotta go faster,
she says through clenched teeth, and nearly bottoms the freighter out against the surface of the destroyer.
There! Just get us clear.
To starboard, the massive towers and shield generators of the Star Destroyer loom over them like jagged cliffs. Dead ahead sits the end of the colossal ship, the bank of its engines. Nora intends to get clear of the destroyer, then bank hard to get out of any weight from its engines. Then, all clear! Punch it! She says. The ship rocks hard, its back end lifting high and sending them into a tumble before she realigns the stabilizers and gets them upright again. The hyperdrive, Wedge says.
It's out. Direct hit.
We're toast, Nora.
I've been toast before. So have you. She pulls up hard, moving back into another roll-off-the-top maneuver.
They won't expect her to do it so soon, though that element of surprise will wear off fast.
And yet here we are.
She flings them off back through the cloud of TIE fighters, moving the freighter as erratically as she can manage. The gamble works, and two of the TIEs try to predict and evade the moth's movement, smacking into each other, leaving behind a blossom of blue flame consumed by the void. Wedge knows the score. He's been in fighters before, and he knows how to get out of the way of a big ship like this. They move fast, but they turn slow. As the moth's weapon systems out-track the TIEs, getting them off their tail, he narrates the plan.
All right. We need to go vertical, perpendicular. You follow?
I follow.
The underbelly of the destroyer. That's where they go. She can slide the ship down over the edge, tucking it under, then launching it straight down through space. The TIEs will still be on them like a bad smell, but it'll give them a chance to get clear of the destroyer.
More alarms. Something else is coming out of hyperspace.
Reinforcements.
Two blips coming in, growing bigger. A pair of enormous ships.
No, no, no.
The reinforcements drop out of light speed.
Wedge whoops with sudden relief.
Because the two ships aren't Imperial ships. They're New Republic ships. One of them is an Alderaanian escort frigate, the Sunspire. And the other is one of the brand new battleships, a Nadiri Mark I Starhawk, one of the few capital ships constructed at the Nadiri dockyards deep inside the Bormia sector. This ship, and all the ships there, are built from a disassembled Imperial craft the New Republic has taken since Endor. The literal spoils of war. Weapons turned by a savior's hand, pointed back at their masters. This Starhawk, Nora recognizes as the Concorde, which now operates under the command of newly minted Commodore Kirsta Augate, who once commanded the frigate right next to it. The front of the Starhawk is like an axe blade, cutting its way through space. It is a foreboding ship, but regal too, in its own way. Sure enough, who comes crackling across the comm but Augate herself?
Hailing New Republic craft Moff, this is Commodore Augate. Time to come on board. We've got this.
With that, the Concorde unleashes its fire. Chapter 12.
Days have passed since her dalliance on Coruscant, and Grand Admiral Ray Sloan feels stuck in a waiting pattern. The pressures of leading an empire have given her no time to take a side trip to Quan Chi, and she sees no way clear of the mire. Her last trip did not go unnoticed. She was able to deflect questions and criticism easily. After all, she is the operating military leader of the Galactic Empire, and many fear the power she wields. The men at this dinner table, however, do not seem to fear her at all. And that upsets her greatly, because they should. This, then, is Admiral Rax's vaunted Shadow Council. She sits at the narrow head of one side, and the opposing head of the table offers only an empty chair where Rax has promised to sit, though he has yet to make a proper appearance. The others dine, all of them watching one another, uncertain as to what this even is. They are suspicious of one another. They are dubious of the situation. Surely each of them fears, quite fairly, that at any point the ground beneath their chairs will suddenly open up, and they will be evacuated into open space, or dropped down into the crushing walls of a garbage compactor, or devoured by some slavering creature. Problem is, none of them think she's the one to fear. They hardly give her a look. The empty chair at the other end of the table? Oh, they can't stop staring at that, can they? Idiots. The Shadow Council, as arranged around the table, consists of 5 Imperials, including herself. Next to her sits Brendel Hux, once Commandant of the Arcanus Academy. Mercurial Swift did his job and rescued the man, and she makes a mental note to get the bounty hunter paid for that work. Hux is a big, blustering, ego-fed pig. Gone a bit to pasture, that one. His gut strains at his buttons. His neck is fat, and his firm jaw has gone soft with an unshorn patchwork of facial hair. He looks haggard, lost, angry. Occasionally he seems to remember that this is a dinner, then dives down into his meal with sudden gusto, shoveling food into his mouth once more. To his right sits Grand Moff Rand, special governor of the exterior. A far-flung slice of the Outer Rim, and the only true Outer Rim sector remaining under Imperial control. His distance from the action explains his survival. The war burned bright across the galaxy, claiming the lives of many of the Empire's most elite members. Rand was not one of those members. He, like many, was at the edges. And those at the edges were, and are, survivors. Sloan counts herself among those survivors. She had been pushed so far from center that her marginalization likely saved her. Rand has the rigidity and the pointedness of a needle. He moves nothing but his eyes. His hands lie flat against the table, and he has not eaten a single bite. Prudent, that. Perhaps he thinks it's poisoned. Or maybe his nerves are just so jangled he cannot contemplate the idea of food. Across the table, General Hodnar Borum, though nobody calls him that. His nickname is the Old Man, because of how long he served the Empire. Hode Borum actually served the original Republic under Chancellor Palpatine. It was he who reportedly led the charge against the Last Stand of the Jedi at the close of the Clone Wars, personally marshaling clone troopers against the mountain fortress of... what was it? Her history training is suddenly failing her. Madar? Morad? Oh, it matters not. Point is, he's a veteran in the truest sense. And she, among others, always wondered why Kenner Loring was made Grand General instead of Hode Borum. Some said he was too old. Others said he was too practical, and he was known for making a show of how little regard he gave the Force, which likely enraged Vader. Borum is old, and his cheeks are marked with deep lines, craggy craters, and dark liver spots. But his eyes are still flinty. They are not clouded over with the fog of age. Those are a young man's eyes. A predator's stare looks back. Last up is her favorite, Ferrik Obdur, Imperial propagandist extraordinaire. He's the only one who looks happy to be here. Nobody is talking. She decides that has to change. Sloane says to Hux, "I'm glad we got you off Arcanis."
"Yes."
He pauses, looking down at the hunk of steaming meat at the end of his fork. He sets it down with a clatter, as if suddenly not hungry.
"I suppose I am too."
"You suppose?"
"The Academy was my life's work. I was good at it. The best of the Empire came out of Arcanis. The very best. And now what?"
"Now we pick ourselves up," Rand says. "We fight back."
Ferrik Obdur gestures with his own cutlery, as if to make a point. Around a mouthful of food, he says,
"We show the rest of the galaxy how it's done, and why we are needed."
With a serrated knife in hand, he points it at Sloane.
"Admiral, you have a good story about that. You should all listen, because when Sloane was a girl..." "Well, go on, Admiral. You tell it."
Her face burns with the sudden attention of the whole table. The propagandist is both correct and obviously playing an angle here, though she's not sure what it is. Either way, she does have a story. A bad childhood on a lawless world, and the Empire swooping in to bring order to chaos. She's about to speak and tell that tale when Hux interrupts.
"These are dark days. Dark days for all of us."
Sloane bristles at being interrupted. Hux undercuts her because he thinks she's not important. It is vital she make a show of countermanding that. Honestly, her greatest desire right now is to slam her fork through the back of his hand and chastise him for the intrusion. But that would defy Rax, and she's aware suddenly of the keen and delicate balance of power. Instead, she does her own brand of undercutting. "Brendel," she says, "I understand you have a son. Not of your wife, an illegitimate child. Will he be the best the Empire has to offer?" That is a stab from a double-sided dagger. First, the fact that he has an illegitimate son. And second, the inference that no matter how good the cadets at his academy became, they still weren't enough to save the Empire from its fate. His eyes pinch and blink, as if he were just slapped.
Armitage is a weak-willed boy. Thin as a slip of paper and just as useless. But I'll teach him. You'll see. He has potential."
Around the table, the others chuckle. A small victory, she thinks, but precious just the same. General Borum dabs at his mouth with a napkin.
"From a military perspective, we do have an interesting inversion here, don't we? We went from being the prominent power in the galaxy to being second. A far second, if the numbers hold. It happened fast, too, proving that the war machine breaks down with too many hits. But I find that many in the Empire still see us as the first and only law in the galaxy. And I wonder if it would be far better to face reality. We have lost that edge.
I agree, Sloane says. It's high time we regard our place in the galaxy with a full awareness unclouded by prejudice. And then it's time to act accordingly. We are the underdogs fighting to save the galaxy.
Yes, Abdur says, clapping his hands. That's exactly it, isn't it? We are the rebellion. We're the resistance. Oh, yes.
He laughs somewhat madly.
Think of it this way. Truth is given to us in two stages. All of this, everything anyone ever does, is only as true as the stories we tell about it. The narrative is the thing. We have to control the narrative. We can be the ones to swoop in and save troubled worlds dwelling in the shadow of the New Republic's ignorance. We put out the message. We control it politically, and then we enforce the narrative militarily. Not the reverse. Too often, we leave